I guess if you Wikipedia ontology and epistemology like I did this morning, you'll find something on the lines of, so ontology is like it's an ology, right? So it's the study of something. So it's like the ontology is the study of the most abstract thing in the world, which is what is the nature of the world. So it's people who study ontology are interested in what is the world like, what are the important features of that world that we should be looking at and making sense of. So I guess if you're a coach, it's kind of, well, what's coaching? You know, what is coaching? What do I believe that to be? What are the important features of coaching that I should be attending to? So that's a kind of ontological question for me.
So welcome back to our second installment of the Coaching Discourse podcast. Anna, Laurie and myself have recovered enough from our first outing with Simon Phelan, Elliot Newell and, of course, Guido, also known as Guy Richardson, to do it all over again. We were taken back by the levels of engagement and feedback we received and, of course, enjoyed revisiting the conversation with Phil Llewellyn and Chris Stott on the two-bit minimum as we continued to generate more questions rather than answers through the sense-making process. And bringing us back to today, I would like to thank our guests for giving up their time to support the podcast. Dave Piggott, Andrew Abraham and Vinnie Webb will be discussing ontology and epistemology with Anna, Laurie and I today as we aim to make sense of what these terms mean and what they mean for sport coaches and athletes alike. Before we offer the floor to Dave, Andrew and Vinnie to introduce themselves, I believe it's perhaps important to share why we pull this episode together. It's not an opportunity to engage in what a colleague on this call described as intellectual masturbation. This platform is never going to be about sharing all the things that we know, but more importantly, it's around engaging in the things that we are most curious about. Certainly, I'm coming at this episode from a place of genuine curiosity, recognizing all that I do not know about ontology and epistemology. And I'll share why my exploration of ecological dynamics recently fed a lot of that curiosity. I believe when we were pulling this episode together, I was engaging in a paper, Theory to Practice, Performance Preparation Models in Contemporary High-Level Sport Guided by an Ecological Dynamics Framework by Woods, McEwen, O'Sullivan, Roberts and Davids. And I was struck by a particular sentence within the paper. From an ecological ontology, self-regulation refers to the development and exploitation of deeply intertwined functional relationships between a performer's actions, perceptions, intentions, emotions, and the environment. Notwithstanding the statement itself commands a degree of inquiry, I believe the use of the word ontology deserved some consideration. Investigating Guinard, Button, Davids, and Seifert, whose paper Education and the Transfer of Water Competencies, an Ecological Dynamics Approach, was referenced, here, there was no mention of an ecological ontology. Instead, it referenced self-regulation relative to an ecological dynamics framework. It made me wonder if the ecological dynamics framework is morphing into an ecological ontology, having rarely seen much of it in the research before, and recognizing that I may not be as well-read as I should be, but well-read enough, I believe that we cannot simply create an ontology. Coupled with that, with the emergence of ontology and epistemology as more common parlance within the UK sporting system, I would be keen to understand the area more. I recognise Dave has highlighted that this is perhaps a challenging subject to discuss in a podcast, but I would like to think that we would go some way to providing some clarity on what we mean when we say ontology and epistemology, and when we say it in reference to sport coaching research, perhaps not necessarily reference to coaching practice. Before we get into the meat and veg, I'll start by inviting our guests in to introduce themselves, and I'd like to welcome Dave into the podcast.
Lovely, thanks, Derek. I'm Dave Piggott. I am a senior lecturer at Leeds Beckett University. My boss is on the call, so I've got to be careful when I say and do. I've been at Leeds now for about 8 years, I think, and I had a little 2-year sojourn in the FA. So I used to be also the head of research for performance insights at the FA for a couple of years. So I've kind of worked out in the industry as well as just being in my ivory tower. I'm probably not qualified to talk about this. I did get interested. I suppose I'm one of those strange people who got interested in philosophy when I was doing my PhD. And so I've got interested in these words, ontology and epistemology, and I had to say something about them when I wrote my PhD. And most people, I think, kind of leave it there. When they finish the PhD, they never return to these things ever again. But I was one of those oddballs who kind of continued my interest. So I've written a few bits and pieces about this in the past. So maybe that's maybe that qualifies me.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks for the invite. My name is Andy Abraham. I'm the head of subject for sport coaching at Leeds Beckett University, and apparently that makes me Dave's boss, but I've never yet had a situation where someone's given a rat's ass about what they say or what they do in front of me, so perhaps today's the new start to that. I've been at Leeds Beckett for 13 years. Background has always been in areas of coach development, coaching practice. Had looks at different areas of those sorts of things. Always been interested in these sorts of things, and actually, you know, coming back to what Dave said about qualification to actually talk about any of this sort of stuff is interesting, because probably my qualifications for talking about it increased when Dave came to Leeds Beckett. What, back in 2010 was it, Dave? 2011. 2012. So Dave brought a lot of that, I suppose, additional intellectual rigor to us as a group, and, you know, expanded our views of the world with this. And then probably also would have to reference my other colleague, Julian North, who's also always been very interested in this sort of work, and his own book around sport coaching research and practice does get into some of these issues as well. So as much as I'd hate to push his book because he'll get rich, I doubt he's getting rich from it anyway, so let's push it anyway. So I'm interested in this. Like Dave, I looked at a little bit within my PhD, and I think there are some fundamental reasons why we should perhaps talk about this, but also some fundamental reasons why we shouldn't get too hung up on it as well. So we'll perhaps get into that later as we progress.
I think one of the other reasons I was keen to bring you into this episode is the episode that you did with Daniel Abrahams, and you spoke specifically around learning theory and epistemology and ontology there also, and I was really keen to take some of that and apply that here today as well, so hopefully we can bring some of that to the table. Vinny, just keen to bring you in as well, bud.
Yeah, no, thanks for the invite, Derek and Anna and Laurie. Quite exciting to see where this goes. I'm going to follow Anna's themes really about biography, because I think it's important to set the scene, because first time for me doing one of these things. I think people, I keep saying I'm an engineer, I served as an apprentice engineer to become an expert, earning a load of money across the world, but still, like everybody, doing community volunteering through coaching, so engineering alongside coaching populations of coach children, juniors, adults, women and men, and disability. I've also done all the different environments from community right through to GB, with my probably best experience doing coaching practice in Georgia. I'm a coach, educator, tutor, done all the qualifications and training like everybody else. Whether that's led to my experience or not, I'm not sure. I've worked in many, many different sports. Worked at Rugby Football League as head of coach development, designing their programmes from 2002, which was the old UKCC programmes. Latterly at head of education at British Cycling, doing the same things, and I've just completed my doctorate, which took me 7 years, professional doctorate, which was looking at the principles of coherent coaching on talent pathways. So yeah, trying to link that, and I've got a real interest of coherence in systems, which is driven by me wanting to know the what, the why and the wherefore, and a little bit of meaning making really, because I do get confused with all the diatribe that's going on currently around the world. Social media.
Thanks, Vinny. And you're really selling this idea of a prof doc or a PhD to myself and Laurie here when you talk about a 7-year journey. I hate to think what age I'm going to be if I complete a PhD if I start now. So thanks very much for sharing that. We're going to ask a 2-part question at the start, which I shared with you. I'll ask the first part. Anna will come in with the second. So what I'll do is I'll perhaps lean on Dave to begin with, if that's okay. Just from your perspective, can you offer the listeners a plainer account of what we mean by ontology and epistemology in the context of sport coaching?
I'd love to. Plain account. So I guess if you Wikipedia ontology and epistemology like I did this morning, you'll find something on the lines of, so ontology is like it's an ology, right? So it's the study of something. So it's like the ontology is the study of the most abstract thing in the world, which is what is the nature of the world. So it's people who study ontology are interested in what is the world like, what are the important features of that world that we should be looking at and making sense of. So I guess if you're a coach, it's kind of, well, what's coaching? You know, what is coaching? What do I believe that to be? What are the important features of coaching that I should be attending to? So that's a kind of ontological question for me. And then the epistemology, again, it's another ology, so it's a study of how do we know about things. Epistem's the old Greek word for a kind of knowledge. And yeah, it's like if you've already made a decision about what the world's like, then you need to again think about how you're going to study it and how you're going to know or develop more robust knowledge of it. So that's the kind of epistemology question. So it's probably connected more to like coach learning and coach development. I think, you know, if we're in that domain, we're interested in how can we help coaches and systems improve their knowledge of their practice, I guess. So yeah, that would be my kind of simple version. You know, what's the world like? How can we know more about it?
No, for sure. And I suppose it leans in on one of the questions I presented in an email exchange that we were going through when, as a system builder here in Scotland, we might ask some of the sports that we work with, what do you believe to be coaching effectiveness in your sport, and how do you know that to be true? Is that, in your view, then perhaps leaning into ontological or epistemological positions or questions?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely are ontological and epistemological questions. Whether or not we often choose to label them as such is, you know, perhaps the debate. So yeah, I think they definitely are. And if a philosopher were to sort of parachute in to those environments, they would definitely recognise them as ontological and epistemological questions. But I just don't think we would use that language in those kind of environments.
No, for sure. And I think that's similar to what Anna and Laurie and I have discussed around whether or not the language is in of itself helpful, certainly within certain levels within the system. But we can't escape the fact that this language is being used within the system currently. So we need to make sense of the context in which they're used. Andy, I'm keen to bring you in just to offer your perspective.
Yeah, I probably won't vary too much from what Dave says. I suppose I came to these views when I was finishing off my PhD, just over 5 years ago, and it was, to me, the ontology, what is something, epistemology, what does that mean for how we go about understanding it, the methodology, okay, what does that mean for how we're going to measure it then? And then there's the fourth bit, which is then, well, what's the impact, what's the point for practice? And I agree with Dave, is that, you know, whilst I started to learn about that and it became interesting to me, I'm not a philosopher. I am a person working in the field of sport coaching and coach development. And, you know, luckily it's amazing what you find out what you are when you read something and goes, oh, that's me. And luckily it's not just horoscopes. So when you get into it, so I'd always been very tied to the idea of relativism, as in things are as they are within a context, but change the context and things might change with it. And apparently relativism is a form of philosophy. Equally, I've always been on the view of going, let's find something that works and let's just crack on. And apparently that's called pragmatism, and there's another branch of philosophy for you. So quite often people will be behaving in certain ways because of the way in which they learn to live their life. And ultimately you find, oh, well, that seems to align with this or align with that. And I think that's probably the truth for pretty much all people working in the field of coaching, which is, what's the most important thing is, can I stand up in front of a group of people and not cock it up for the next hour, which is, my guess is the truth for a lot of people is, you know, we could then get into the who, what, how, and all these sorts of different things, but ultimately it's, I've got a group of people here for an hour and I don't look an idiot. And if you can get beyond that, you're probably doing all right, to be honest. So I will go back and say, when I got into this, to me, an ontological question became, what is coaching? And then you get into, well, what does that mean for the way in which we want to understand coaching and therefore research it, and therefore what impact does that have on practice? My guess is there's people around who would listen to that and go, that's a fairly simplistic view of it. And I'd be going, yeah, that's fine. I'm quite happy for someone to say that that's quite a simplistic view of it, because to me, that's pragmatic for where we are in the field that we're studying.
Thanks, Andy. And just listening to what you were saying has me really curious around this idea of ontological ignorance. Is it okay to not necessarily know that you've got an ontological position, although you naturally are going to possess one, right?
I hope so, because that pretty much reflected me, to be honest.
Thank you very much, Vinny. I'm keen to invite you in, and again, you may begin to talk about your working on epistemological chains when you start giving up your planar accounts. I'm really keen to listen to what you have to say. Your work is influencing the work that I'm doing at the moment, and it is influencing Laurie's work, I'm aware, as well. So we're really keen to hear what you've got to say.
Yeah, thanks for that, Derek. It's nice to hear that the work's influencing people. I think probably like Andrew, really, I'm going to go that I'm a practitioner, and quite clearly I had lots of questions and I didn't understand how to answer them. So I ended up, as you can see, going through lots of books, and sometimes those books didn't give me the answer. So I ended up in the ologies, if you like, epistemology, ontology, which framed part of my thesis, which was based around pragmatism, really. And I realised that we all have them, but we don't realise we have them in terms of explicit or implicit. And I think some of mine are still not quite clearly there, as I think so. They are quite clearly implicit, but it guides my, I suppose, frame of reference of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, really. Certainly on a philosophical level, but a personal level. And I think when we start talking about the epistemological chain, we start looking at organisational level. And I think we've all got them, but we don't know we've got them. We don't know what's driving our assumptions. I think it's back to the biography side of things, understanding what makes us who we are and what has been our terms of reference throughout our lives, really. And I've been looking, I like preparation, mate. I don't go anywhere without a coach with a preparation. And I like one thing that Richard Freeman wrote: what policymakers learn is a function of what they believe and the way they think. Policymakers have mindsets or habits of attention. And I think that goes back to Anna's work around who we are, why we are, what the environments that we've come up in, have been brought up in, that affects our decision making. And I think the epistemological chain starts talking about decision making and what that relevance is to that. So yeah, purely practitioner level, do we need to call them epistemology or ontologies? I think we need to identify that we have them, and it shapes our learning, it shapes our environment and the way we go through things within the world. So yeah, might be a little bit deep, hopefully not with you esteemed colleagues, but I think it's, and it says in the paper that we wrote, is ultimately that coaches need to be aware of how they learn, why they're learning, and why certain things have a relevance to them.
Oh, the Vinny's just thrown a spanner in the works, and he's like drawn my own work into the conversation, which I hadn't planned on speaking about. But it makes me wonder, what's the difference between like biography, epistemology, and ontology? I can mull on that myself while other people think about what the planned question actually was. So I guess some people have shared their stories of why they think they might be qualified to speak about this area, and I suppose my experience of it is studying for a master's at Loughborough University. In our research methods classes, I remember being told that you must understand these things, and I was like, no, I just can't understand it. I'm just not going to bother engaging with it. And then sadly enough, I stayed on to do a PhD, and then I couldn't say no a second time and couldn't get away with not engaging with it. So yeah, I was forced to do it, but the fact that we're sort of discussing this suggests that we think this is of value for coaches and coach developers. So what do our guests think, starting with Dave? Do you think there's a value in coaches and coach developers understanding these things? And if so, what do you think the value is?
Yes and no. I go back, I think, so my biography on it is strikingly similar to yours, actually. Master's at Loughborough University, being told I needed to know about this stuff. So I wasn't convinced I did at the beginning. I wasn't convinced it was helpful. It was a means to an end, really. But the more I thought about it over the years, and of course, you know, we're in the position of having to, well, we're fortunate position of being able to think about this stuff and read about it and write about it and talk to people about it quite a lot. So I recognise I'm in it. A fortunate position as well as an academic, and I suppose my first part of the answer is it useful. I think there's some ideas that are useful, and I'll share a couple that I've found useful and why. But again, whether or not people need to sort of then study these branches of philosophy, I'm not sure. I think some of the ideas that come from these domains of knowledge are useful. So the first example I guess I'd give is the one that struck me and made most sense to me when I was studying, and since as I've been teaching students and developing coaches, is in epistemology. So that's the question of, you know, how do we know anything? And I got interested in a sort of sub branch of that, which is philosophy of science, because philosophers have been interested in science because it seems to be the kind of field of human work where we seem to be doing quite well. You know, we seem to be developing quite robust knowledge of the world, and you know, it seems to be quite useful. It's driven technologies and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So I started reading philosophy of science, and I came upon the work of a guy called Karl Popper, who was a very famous philosopher of science from the last century. And Popper had this, he had a couple of big ideas that I've been drawn to, and they're ideas that I try to communicate to the students and to other coaches, and, you know, where they're just good ideas, good thinking tools, I think. So if we get back to this question of how do we know anything, you know, so as a coach, I'm operating with theories all the time, whether they're implicit or explicit, whether I know them or not. I'm all my practice, the way that I plan, the way that I deliver, the way that I review, the way that I interact with people is all guided by theory. And most of it's probably implicit and tacit. You know, I'm not that aware of it. And so one of the tasks, I think, as coach developers is to help coaches or organizations develop better theories. You know, how do we know that this theory is better than that one? You know, if I chose at any point in time to get two theories out, you know, pedagogical theories or whatever, and inspect them, how do I know one's better than the other? And Popper's, one of his ideas was that, well, all the theories we've got aren't true. So his first kind of big idea was it's fallibilism, that everything's wrong, basically. All theories that we've got are wrong. And therefore it's, but there, it is possible to determine if one theory is better than another. So there's better and worse theories. And one of his tests or his ideas is that if you had two different theories and you're trying to figure out which one's best, which one to use, which one to move forward with, you can do that by thinking about how well they've been tested. So how many challenges, how much criticism have they survived? And his idea was that if you've got a theory that survived more harsher criticism than another, then that's the one you should go with. And so what we try and do in our degree courses and master's programs is to sort of get those theories out and encourage our coaches to get out their theories, be explicit about them, which theories you guide in your practice. And then we ask the question of, well, how well, to what extent does it survive some pretty harsh criticism and tests? And if it has, then it's probably good to go. If it hasn't, you might want to think about what alternatives there are out there. So that ability to sort of think critically about the theories we're using that guide our practice, I think, is a really important principle. So that's one that I would offer. I could probably offer another one, but I don't want to kind of step on the toes of my colleagues. Maybe they want to jump in and respond with another example.
Andy's just run away, so clearly not.
Literally run away.
So it looks like Vinny's up next. So what do you think, Vinny? Is it worth understanding ontology and epistemology as a coach or a coach developer?
I think since we've organised this session, I've obviously had another read through, and I'm not sure about that in terms of the language. The language is really challenging, depending where you are within the system, I think, what role you play in the system. But I think quite clearly that we do talk about a personal epistemology and understanding how that can shape your practice, your beliefs, your philosophical underpinnings to drive your practice. And I think David mentioned that, and it does drive your decisions and actions, but perhaps it is implicit where we go. I do think that if we can get coaches to understand their personal epistemology or their personal understanding, their more self-awareness on that level, on that deeper level, it would help, in my words, have a coherent pathway, because we can work together on the pathway to build relationships, if you like, look at goal setting, all those things that we talk about being in a good environment for talent development, where currently the coaches are not clearly aware of themselves, albeit in Coach Ed, we talk about understanding yourself in understanding your coaching philosophy, but it's a little bit deeper than that, isn't it, in terms of understanding who you are. And I think that that's really key for me. But again, I'm very different, that I wanted to know who I am, and I still really don't know at my age who I am. I think I'm learning, which sounds a bit crazy, but still learning day to day. And I had a great conversation with Julian North last week, and it's still the same thing, who I am, what frame of reference, what position I am. I'm moving along the continuum of positions. So I think it's unhelpful lower down in the pathway, but I think being able to articulate who you are, why you're doing certain things are really important. Hence, I keep coming back to your paper, Anna, because I think, you know, it's really important that it links to this work. You know, your biography can't just be your biography in terms of experience without knowing who you are around ontology or epistemology. And I've got learned colleagues who are much more experienced in this. But like everybody else, it becomes complicated. You engage in it when you're doing your theses. By the way, Derek, it was 8 years. I had to have a year off because I was working as well. So it was 8 years and a lot of money. But I think understanding yourself on that journey and understanding what makes people tick and why they don't, that's really, really important.
Benny, I wonder if, given the explanation that you've just offered around what a personal epistemology is, could you give us some examples of how that can support a coherent approach to athlete development? I guess some of the implications for the athletes and for the coaches in understanding that better.
Yeah, I think the different coaches, because I think Shoma, we talk about naive and sophisticated epistemologies, personal epistemologies, and Grekic and Collins and others talk about the same thing of understanding how it affects your practice. So we're having lots of debate around drills or ecological ways of approaching your practice, but the coaches need to know and understand why they're doing that, because their practices are affected by their epistemology, the relationships with athletes, the planning in terms of short-termism or long-termism that we're looking with. We are trying to go long-term development of our athletes, whereas a coach with a naive epistemology may be looking at doing very things short-term, looking at the day-to-day delivery, if you like. And the future, I mentioned like the future direction, so planning the here and now. I think one of the key things, and it's a few papers to come out yet from my studies, is suggesting that the coaches don't really know what they're doing. They're just doing what's been told, and that goes through the pathway. And I think there's an awful lot of coaches that were involved in that. And we asked them about, do they understand about knowledge and whether knowledge is certain or whether knowledge is tentative, all the things that are structure of knowledge, sorry, the control of learning, the speed of learning, all those things. And the coaches didn't know, but their practice was sometimes sophisticated them, very naive. And obviously that does link to Shoma as well. So I think it's getting them to understand why they're doing what they're doing rather than just doing it.
Can I jump in and ask a question here as well? Just, and it's probably aligned to some of the threads that were going on Twitter earlier on this week. And I think Andy, you perhaps also engaged in it as well, where, and I think it comes around every couple of months, this challenge around academic language and practitioners being to engage within it, and probably leans on what you're saying there, Vinny, around lack of epistemological literacy. We look at things and we on face value. So let's say, for example, a constraints-led approach. Oh, well, yeah, I use constraints in my coaching, but I don't necessarily know why I'm using it. And people see it as a model through which you might coach rather than a framework to understand movement behavior. So the way in which that framework was intended is not necessarily being appropriated in the right way, because we look at things with face validity. And I really, this is probably where I think the value is around bridging the gap between academia and practice, but not necessarily to bring academia down, but to bring practice up towards research, to be able to speak in or understand the language. Because the academics have done all the heavy lifting around understanding the underpinnings behind coaching practice. So I believe that there is a value associated with understanding, not necessarily ontology per se, but epistemology, certainly, because we need to be able to understand the underpinnings of why things work, with who, where and why. So on that note, I'm really keen to just bring Andy in, sorry, Anna, to see what he thinks about what I've just said there.
Yeah, thanks, Derek. It's an interesting one, because actually, if we follow what Vinny's saying in terms of, let's say, what are the best views around this idea of how people start to understand what knowledge is, which we could argue is like an epistemological development. It's not epistemology, it's an epistemological development, which again, people might go, what the hell are you on about? Which actually reflects the, you know, what we've just been saying. The question around language, of course, anyone who's trying to communicate a message should do the best that they can to communicate that message. And, you know, that just stands to reason. And, you know, and I've sat and read papers as a reviewer sometimes and thinking, what are you trying to achieve with this paper? But there is another view on this, which I think is important, which comes back to what you're getting into there, I think, Derek, is that if you follow the view of someone like a guy called William Perry, who isn't a fridge from American football, which I always have to point out, he might well have been a philosopher, but I don't know. But William Perry talked about there being 9 stages of knowledge development, metacognitive knowledge development, or epistemological development, whichever those words you want to go with, which essentially was saying that we go from a very naive dualistic view of the world, which is there is a right answer and there is a wrong answer, through to relativism, through to committed relativism, where relativism talks about the answer is dependent on the context within which the answer dependent on the context within which the question is being asked. Which is, if you like, that the bottom, the underpinning of the it depends view of the world. As people keep saying, yeah, you can't just keep saying it depends. You've eventually got to arrive at an answer. And that arrival at an answer is what Perry would talk about, your capacity to create, achieve committed relativism, which is, yeah, I know there's lots of other stuff going on, but eventually I've got to come up with something here. I can't just keep going, well, it depends, and hope to get away with it. Now, there is an impact on that, which Perry talks about, which is you can only therefore understand what your current capacity allows you to understand. So if you are still at dualism, then the likelihood is that there's a lot of academic papers which are not going to make any sense to you because you're not in a position yet to understand it. And that's not necessarily about the language which is within it. It's about the complexity of the message which is being communicated in that paper. So as someone who is, so I would like to think that I have a good understanding, I recognize that the world is relative. So I might pick up a paper, this is really dense and really complicated, but it shouldn't stop me working out how I eventually want to understand what that paper is saying, because I should know that actually things are relative. So if there's things in this paper I don't understand, I should now have the tools to go away to learn what those things mean in order for me to understand it. So that comes back to what I think you're saying, Derek, which is, you know, this has to be a two-way street in some ways when we get into these things, which is if you pick up a paper and you consider yourself to be cognitively developed and it doesn't make sense to you, then actually the onus is a bit on you to go and make sense of it. If, however, we are, you know, as an educator, I am saying to someone, this paper is really important and you better understand it soon, otherwise I'm going to fail you, without ever recognizing their capacity to understand it from the outset, then that makes me a poor educator and therefore a poor communicator. So I think there's an element of we might come back to, why would I give a first year student a complex paper to read, knowing full well they're going to struggle to understand it? Well, actually, the reason why I might give them that is to help them understand that they don't understand it. Which is, you know, it's a tool to start dragging them along the, and sometimes it is dragging for some people, they take to it, is that it starts to help me help them understand that there's different ways in which they need to start viewing the world. So actually it serves a purpose, but it might not be the purpose that the author of the paper had when they wrote it. So it comes back to a horses for courses approach. So, there are papers which are written poorly, and I'm not going to say which those are because I might have a view, but someone else might not have that view. And that someone might have a view of the paper I've written, and that's fine. The people can say that. But I think we need to be careful of the question around that all papers are poor because they don't use language which is accessible, because accessibility is dependent on the person who's trying to access it. So I'm wary of that view of the world. And I'm also wary of the view that actually papers probably aren't the best place to start if we're trying to educate a workforce. When there's, you know, I've got a book shelf over there, I mean, Vinnie's bookshelf behind, there's loads of stuff in there that we could point people to, which would inform, go and inform their practice, which you go, well, I wouldn't even start reading that. Have a read of this and get their sense of the view of the world. So, you know, so those biographies, so I would generally, you know, if I sort of want to understand that things are complex, I'll probably point them to a the biography of a coach, which is A, it's interesting to read because it's connecting, and B, we've got something we can get involved with them. So I think that has an impact on what we decide is easy to access and not easy to access. And so there isn't a, you know, so going back to relativism, the answer to the question is dependent on the person we're asking the question about, really, I think.
Thanks, Andy. I'm going to invite Dave in. Dave's got a point.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was the original point I wanted to make, but you put something in the chat there, Derek, that I thought was really interesting. So I think it's a point I was going to raise is about the importance of mediators or people, translators, people who can, you know, really good coach developers, I think, do this job really well. You know, my colleague Bob Muir is an absolute master of this, that, you know, he can take some of those ideas that might be a little bit impenetrable, you know, break through them. Remember, we're academics. We're paid to do this. We're given time, lots of time to read and make sense of this kind of stuff and teach it to people. So we're very fortunate in that position. But I think, yeah, good ones like Bob are excellent at helping to translate and get the crux of the idea across in a way that the coach can grasp in their context, that's meaningful to them at the right time and place and everything else. You also mentioned there about NGBs, and I want to come back to, I thought about this morning. I think NGBs could also do that job, but I'm a bit wary of the way that they might do that. So it's back to my Popperian principles. And I'll give you an example. So a few years ago, UK Coaching, or might have been Sport Coach UK at the time, put out a tender for asking universities, people working in universities, to articulate the principles of self-determination theory for coaches. So take this theory and translate it into a way that coaches can then grasp and understand, and what those principles mean, what would the application look like. And I thought that was really interesting for a couple of reasons. One is, like, I think it's good that they're striving to do that translation job and support coaches in that way. But it did strike me as odd that they would just pick a theory. They would pick one theory of many, you know, so self-determination theory is a theory of motivation, and there are many other theories of motivation. So why pick self-determination theory? And there are some ideas out there, there are some theories, and this comes back to your point, Derek, about the, you know, ecological psychology or ecological dynamics, which is that some of these theories, and I've done a study of self-determination theory, become almost like ascend to become like irrefutable. You know, they're almost like nobody will have any criticism of them. And some of the Twitter debates you see online are people defending their positions. People become very defensive, and that's one thing that can happen in our world is that people become very defensive of particular theories or positions. And I think it's our job to, again, to read them critically, to ask ourselves, again, the Popperian thinking tool requires us to ask, is this theory even sticking its neck out? Is it even making itself testable? Because if it's not testable, if it's not making hypotheses that we can test and check and challenge, then, you know, it's not very useful to us. We can't, you know, if we can't test it, we can't determine how truth-like it is. And it just becomes a shouting match. So back to the UK coaching thing, I think I'd have been more interested if they'd put out, you know, could some academics compare and determine which theories of motivation are the most truth-like or the most useful at this moment in time, which has passed the most tests, and then take it and figure out how to support coaches to understand it and apply it. So I think we've got to be really careful of that. I think particularly our job as academics, or, you know, learned coaches, need to be really watchful of the theories and ideas that we're using. Check are those theories making predictions that we can check and challenge. You know, are they sticking their necks out? And if they're not, you should be starting to smell a bit of a fish.
It's quite an interesting one, Dave. And I think I had this a slight debate with Stu Armstrong on Twitter, of all places, the other day about this. And it's just, from my perspective, it's not necessarily about what's right and wrong, but it's around what's more or less compelling around the argument that somebody is positioning around why you might or might not use a certain disciplinary perspective or a certain approach to sport coaching, which, again, bringing it back to the premise of today's episode around how ontologically or epistemologically robust is this position or this approach. And I think at times, I'm going to say ecological dynamics doesn't put itself in a really good place around how robust their theories actually are. And of course, when you start questioning some of those theories, dare I say it, how you can compare a spider hunt against prey to tactical decision making in invasion team sports, then you really start considering, like, what kind of world is it that we live in? Genuinely, what kind of world is it that we live in?
I think it's just on that point, again, I'll just draw, because I did the study. So a few years ago for a book, I did a short study of all the papers that have been published in sports psychology journals in the last 5 years in using self-determination theory. So there's 26 papers that I reviewed. And I was reviewing them particularly to see, did they have findings or evidence that was effectively contrary to the theory, you know? And then what did they do about it? And there's about half the papers came up with or generated evidence that didn't really fit with the theory. You know, it was a bit kind of contrary to self-determination theory. But in every single case, the researchers kind of just made an excuse, or we must have done it wrong. You know, we must have applied the wrong test. The stats must have been wrong. They didn't use their work to challenge the theory. And so academics aren't doing it either. And that's the point. You know, the researchers themselves aren't challenging the theories. I would argue it's probably the same thing in that field that we've been talking about, you know, in the field of constraints and ecological psychology. Nobody who writes about that stuff actually challenges the ideas that are central to it. And that's the academic. So why would expect coaches to be able to do that? Or, you know, it might be too high a bar to expect, you know, coaches and practitioners to do that if the academics aren't even doing it themselves.
Cheers, Dave. Laurie, would you want to come in there?
Yeah, just going back to this notion of language being perceived as a barrier. I just wonder, do you notice, therefore, at times there are particular theoretical concepts that are used more or less because the language is seen as more or less accessible?
I come from, my academic background is in sociology and policy. I used to find people were actually attracted to very complex language, you know, because like things that are profound are hard to understand. Therefore, it's hard to understand. It must be profound, you know, that kind of weird fallacy. But I found that people were really quite drawn to the complex and almost wanted to get lost in it and mystified by it, which was never really for me, to be honest. But I found that a bit strange.
I would just follow up on that. I think there is no doubt, this comes back to what I was saying before about the echo chamber issue, is that that there is a tendency for, and again, I don't think people do it deliberately, and I don't think there's some, you know, massive conspiracy somewhere about trying to keep people out, but there's sometimes, you know, everyone is prone to impression management, and so the, you know, the people trying to create language, and you think, well, who's that language for, and what are you trying to do? Because actually, even if, let's go back to what I was saying before, let's say even say someone is at that relativist stage, but someone is trying to influence that person. If they don't influence them quickly, you know, starts to go, this is nonsense, this is too hard, I could probably spend the next 10 hours or 20 hours working out what the hell they're saying, but I'd be equally a bit annoyed that they didn't just say it like that in the first place. So, you know, everyone's prone to that. And so, you know, I think there is the point of how do we want to layer these things, and language is part of that. So You know, and this comes back to where do we want to start? And typically people want to start with practice, and eventually they get further and further back into reflecting more and more deeply on why they are what they are. And I think that's always been the case. And that's certainly been the case for me, is that where do we start? We start with the thing which is closest to us. So I would, you know, so again, coming back to the issue around papers, I think my question would be is, well, why are we going to papers anyway when there's such good book chapters around which summarise key things? You know, and some of those things might be around reflective practice, which might ask you to challenge the things you've just read, but, you know, at least, and it'll do that in an accessible way. But so I think there is a way in which we can layer these things through to take people on a journey which moves them towards this idea of, well, my view is from dualism to relativism. But equally, you know, if we follow the idea of talent development, which says we should put some hurdles in the way sometimes, and actually chucking in something which is a bit difficult and a bit challenging is actually a good thing, because it starts to challenge whether or not are you up for this? Do you want to go on this journey? And it's one of the things that Perry and Entwistle, who then talked about Perry's work, said, some people get to the point of, and in this case it's called multiplism, and just go, this is too difficult, and revert back to something which is, in inverted commas, easier. Now, that might have as much to do with the support they were being offered at the time as much as anything else, to be honest. But we know that these things exist. So language is obviously incredibly important. But I think it's part of the educator's role is to decide, well, where is it I'm trying to take you, and what's the most accessible way for me to do that, to take you on the journey I'm trying to take you on? So I just think your point, Laurie, is really important, is it's, let's get into the language that we want people to move on to. I can see Vinny wants to come in on that as well.
Just before we come to Vinny, I was just going to make a point on what we said at the start around the language of ontology and epistemology seeping into the sporting system. Why do we think that is? And is it helpful that now I might turn up at a meeting with colleagues at EIS or the Institute or wherever, and the terms are being banded about? And I mean, I will hold my hands up and say at times I use them without necessarily entirely knowing what they mean, because socially we feel like perhaps we need to or we have to within the context of that situation. Going back to your point around impression management, I don't necessarily want to appear in those arenas as not necessarily knowing the same as or as much as the people that I'm in meetings with. But why are these terms being used within the sporting system by practitioners just now? Like, can we point to where that came from?
I'd offer an initial view, which comes, it was a guy I used to work with at the FA, a guy called Richard Hodgson, who is, again, very pragmatic sort of guy. But he would say, you know, football's full of people who think they've got the secret sauce. You know, and as soon as something becomes commonplace, someone's then looking for the next thing, which is going to be the new secret sauce. And I think in some ways it shows the growth and maturation of the sporting sector, that people are now starting to have to go to those sorts of words in order to actually create the new secret sauce. Now, that may or may not be particularly helpful. You know, someone wants to be the next, who's got the next best answer? You know, you get into things like marginal gains and all that sort of stuff, when you go, well, there's still some fundamental things we have to get into. But that, my view would be, is that because people find that they're getting up to speed, well, what's the next layer of thing I can now offer you to show you that I'm still relevant? I think there may be something about around that within it. But equally, I think it's also a reflection of how the sporting sector is professionalizing to become more aware of things that they might need to be aware of as well.
I'm coming in on secret sauce and marginal gains, and both have a real affinity to myself. I think this sort of brings us back, Derek, and all to personal epistemology, doesn't it? Because I think for me, I've always been challenging, I think I've mentioned it to Andy in my Viber and so on and so forth, that I think I've always challenged everything. I've always challenged knowledge. I've always challenged, someone's asked me to do something, I go, why? I want to understand. And it's been the same through the DProf, that I decided I was going to use pragmatism and go, well, why? And then I've ended up with buying two books on pragmatism I can't read. And I think as understanders, I want to know a little bit more about it. Whereas you see things and people push things out and people don't want to know, they just take it at face value. So I'd like to think I'm sophisticated in my epistemology, wanting to know why and delving in further to find the answer, albeit I never find the answer. And then somebody's naive is that they accept that the answer is being pushed out there by someone of a higher level or with authority, and then they accept that. And I think you see that in coaching practice, don't you? Quite clearly you do. So I think epistemology does have a place for people to understand why things are right or wrong or not working as you'd expect them to. And I don't believe there's a secret source.
Cheers, Vinny. I'm reminded of a conversation I had with Tim Jones, who's a football coach developer. Dave, you might be aware of him. Well, we talked about coaches developing personal theories rather than simply regurgitating or replicating the theories of others. But in doing so, they need to understand where the synthesis or the genesis of those ideas or personal theories came from. And to do so, they need to delve into the sources of that knowledge. So it's one thing to say that you've got a personal theory or a personal epistemology. It's another thing then to say where those theories have come from, which I think is a crucial endeavor, certainly within coaches who are becoming more learned or more evidence based in their approach. I'm just keen to understand if you've got some thoughts on that, Vinny.
I suppose as a practical example, I mean, when I went coaching in Georgia for a period of over 2 years, is that, you know, I couldn't go there with the recipe of coaching quite clearly because I was working through a translator. So I was the translator of knowledge through a translator to the practitioners. So I think if I didn't understand the context, the environment, my position, it would be very hard to do that. So I think checking and challenge the knowledge in the context, but I think you only get that with practice and experience, don't you? And I think being inquisitive, we keep talking about we don't have enough people that are critical and criticality. And I think that's because if I see a big word on telly and I don't understand it, I'll go and Google it or try and find out what it actually means and dig further down. So I think it's not accepting what you see based on my epistemological position, I think.
Hello. Benny, you just said there that you think there's not enough people in sport, I think, correct if I'm wrong, that don't think critically. Do you think there's an element of sport that selects for those individuals? I know that's a horrendous generalisation, but I just wonder what led you to say that.
No, I'm thinking of doing some further study in sociology. I think I'm understanding the environment, the culture, the whole education system, I think, starts to affect what's going on, because sport is just a microcosm of what's going on in the world, isn't it, and the environment, really. So I'm not answering the question. I just think...
I couldn't agree more, and we're in this sort of plethora of and disinformation that's just available at the ping of a phone.
Yeah, if I can come in on that, I think so it connects to what Derek was talking about earlier as well. So one of the things that we try to sort of theory of learning, if you like, professional learning, which I think applies quite well in coaching, you know, that a lot of people make reference to it. So this guy Donald Shon wrote an important book back in the 1980s called The Reflective Practitioner. And in there, we talked about a theory of learning called reflection in action. And I think that's been taken up and adopted by a lot of people in the coaching world. And really all he's saying there is a little bit like I was saying, and I think what Vinny's describing his approach is. So that's Vinny's personal epistemology, but Sean's saying, well, this is how all good professionals learn, which is, you know, you have your theories and your theories are largely sort of tacit, you know, and they guide what you do. And every now and again, your theories lead you into a bit of trouble. So what you thought was going to happen doesn't happen. You know, something unexpected happens. And those moments when that happens when you're a coach are what you call like good problem setting moments. So I think good critical thinking coaches, good professional learners are quite deliberate in terms of noticing when there's that kind of clash between what they expected to happen and what actually happened, and use that as a point of reflection and start to ask themselves, well, why did that theory lead me into trouble here? Why didn't it work? Or my expectation. And that's quite hard to do, I think. I don't think many coaches naturally do that easily. And so one of the things that we try to do in our courses is to help our young coaches develop clearer expectations, and then to help them in time generate more explicit theories and views about why do they think this is going to happen in their session. And if you can do that over time, you know, people need help with that and support, they get better at doing it themselves. And then once they can do it themselves, then they can start to critique and they can start to ask those critical questions of the theories that are guiding their practice. And so at a really practical level, I think that kind of idea of reflection in action and encouraging people to make more explicit the theories that are guiding them and then be critical of those theories or hold them up to criticism, ask questions about them deliberately, is a useful thing to do. It's something we try and do with in our programmes, I guess, yeah.
I'm going to jump in. I was just interested to know if Andy got his point across about linking ontology, epistemology, understanding to coach development and whether that links to what David's saying there, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to my PhD work, but also it was the bit where it made me a bit more, I became more clear about what it was, I think, where this could help. I mean, ultimately, I think one of the things that I think we'll get into, why do we need to get into a ontology and epistemology, could be the consequence that our behaviour potentially has on others. And perhaps the bigger the consequence, the more important these sorts of things come. And this was sort of brought home to me a few years ago when I didn't realise I was starting to get into ontology at the time, but where, myself and my colleague Dave Collins have been fairly critical of the competency-based approach within coach education. And actually, if we get into that, then there's you can come back and go, well, where did that come from? And that ultimately came from very much I think it's called Skills Active at the time, which was very interested in occupational standards. And they essentially drew on HR literature, which came from a very behaviourist point of view, which talked about, can we define behaviours that people should have in order to do this job? And hey presto, the competency-based system within coach education was born. Now, I doubt anyone really ever went through an ontological and epistemological view of that, but actually you stand back and go, that's a very behaviourist view of the world, which when you read literature talks about a technical rationality of how we view these things. And that led us to these long, long lists of behavioural competencies that coaches should have, which actually didn't necessarily match the complexity of the job that they were meant to match. But that came from people taking a view of practice without going back to, well, what's the ontological position that this actually might reflect? And do we really want that? So, and I think that's where we got dragged down a very strange path. And Vinny probably has been, as part of someone who's in that NGB world, probably experienced that as much as anyone. Now, I think that had very major consequences on coach education for a long period of time. And, it led to the creation of the coach education assessor, who had to be different from the educator. And I just looked and go, that's a really weird world we're getting into, where we remove assessment from the person who educated. And I know schools have been doing that for years and years, but you think, well, part of education is assessment. So if I can't give you feedback on your assessment, I'm not doing part of my job as an educator. So that became a strange one to me. Which is why when I got into this with my PhD, and obviously we've talked very much around this judgment decision making point of view, saying if coaching is judgment about judgment decision making and consequence of that, then that has an impact on the way in which we might want to talk about it, and therefore the way in which that might impact on practice. So very deliberately, therefore, if you were to look at our degree and our master's degree, they are written around learning outcomes which reflect professional judgment is decision making, which then has an impact on our teaching practice, which then has an impact on our assessment practice. So there is a chain all the way through from an ontological view through to the practice on the ground. And we are happy with the alignment across those things. We're aware that there's things that doesn't do, but we're happy with that's doing what we'd like it to do. That means we've reflected on the assumptions and the reasons why we're doing what we're doing. And I think without that, we end up with big systems which might become not what we expected them to become, but actually we'd have taken an ontological and epistemological view from the outset. We might have foreseen the issues which were going to come down the road by doing that. That's why, to me, when you get into the consequence of actions, it's probably the bigger the consequence, the more you probably need to be getting into this sort of thing.
Cheers, Andy. And as somebody responsible for designing a new framework for coach education in Scotland since we retired UKCC in March of this year, you've given me a lot to chew on over that over that segment that you've just offered us there, something that I might perhaps make sense of as well within the two beer minimum. I'm going to just lean on the quickfire questions just to wrap us up, if that's okay, or the quickfire question. And just going around the houses again, just asking one last time, and I'll start with Vinny. If coaches were to understand only one thing about ontology and epistemology, what would that be?
Where knowledge emanates from, understanding that.
Cheers, Dave.
Yeah, I think it's more epistemology than ontology, but recognise that your theories are guiding your practice. All those theories are wrong or not true. And so what we need to do is try and work with better theories, and better theories are the ones that have passed more tests and more critical discussion. So check that out.
Andy?
I'll go back to what I said at the beginning. What is the thing that you think you're looking at? What the implications for what that means about how you're going to understand it, and what does that mean for how you're going to measure it, and therefore what does that mean for your practice?
It just leaves me to thank Laurie and Anna, and of course our guests Dave, Andy and Vinny for contributing to the episode. I think from the outset we weren't necessarily quite sure where it was going to go, and I think that was perhaps reflected in some of the comms that we had in advance. But what I will say is I'm really taken back by how we've navigated the subject, or dare I say the guests have navigated the subject with sensitivity and humility, and tried to reflect the subject area in a way that is as accessible as possible for the people who are going to be listening to the episode. So I do thank you very much for that. Anna, Laurie, do you have any parting words, thoughts?
Other than it was great fun and I learned some stuff, so thanks.
Yeah, thank you all for your contributions, and I can't wait to make sense of this next week over a couple of beers.